and couldn't be ignored. The strength of my hope pulsed away like a shock front, shattering the heaped glass around me and pushing Saraja and Mevish back a step. Mevish would have fallen into the crater if a braid of her hair hadn't snaked out, steadied her. "What in the name of the Lotan's burning scrotum was that?" Saraja yelled. "Are you trying to get the attention of every soul sorcerer and glass dragon in the entire desert?" "Oops. It was an accident," I said.
"Your accident could mean all our deaths," said Mevish. My face warmed. She was right. I didn't really know what I was doing. If there were any enemies in the crater below, then they probably felt my fumbling attempt at magic, and now knew we were here. Although the blandly white fog remained as enigmatic as when we first saw it. Sadly, no rings had dropped out of the sky or appeared in my waiting palm. If they had, I would have shown them to Mevish and Saraja and been vindicated. As it was, I decided to study my boots. Saraja tapped me on the shoulder. She said something in a quiet voice, but I'd been too absorbed in feeling bad about myself to catch it.
"Sorry," I said. "The musicians are back," she whispered. The sound floated up from the crater softly, with just a bit of an echo. Quick and sharp, I heard strings, both played and plucked, drums, and the same flute from before, fluttering up and down the scale. No voices. Though I tried, hearing the sound without visual cues apparently wasn't enough for me to name it with my residue of maker's ability. We just listened. The music continued for several minutes, then died away. "I'm no expert," I said, stowing Jusher again, "but that sounded sad." Mevish nodded slowly, her eyes downward. Saraja's ears flicked, and she said, "I've tied off the rope. Let's descend and see for ourselves. I'll go first. Carter, you're next. Mevish, bring up the rear." Saraja was braver than me. That was obvious, and I was glad not to be the first down the rope. Ashamed at the thought, I vowed to see things through, whatever we found. The Keflin put together a sort of harness using a long scarf. Watching her, I realized I needed something similar. I fashioned something I hoped was workable from extra rope in my own pack. I checked the knots twice. If I screwed up, I'd have no one to blame but myself. It occurred to me that maybe I should try to enchant the makeshift harness as I'd done to Jusher. But the idea of a talking harness was too bizarre. One semi-sentient found object with unknown capabilities was probably one too many to carry around already. Good as her word, the Keflin descended the rope first. After she was a good 10 feet down, I tightened my makeshift harness, secured it around the descending rope, and put my weight on the line. Too bad I was fresh out of carabiners. Mist closed in overhead as I descended, until Mevish, silhouetted by the bright light as she stared over the edge, faded in the pearly whiteness. Just as I lost sight of the strange woman, she raised her hand and waved at me, as if in farewell. Damn it! Was she backing out? If so, I prayed she would just walk away and not cut our rope out of spite. Saraja's occasional sharp breaths, grunts, and clack of boots on stone rose from beneath me. My own hands grew hard to see as the mist thickened the deeper I went, so applied myself to paying attention to the small details of my descent, putting Mevish out of my mind. Finally, my feet touched down on dark stone and a thin layer of broken glass. Untying the rope from my makeshift harness was a moment's work, and I stowed it in my pack. Even with the harness, ascending was going to be a lot more challenging than coming down. Something to worry about later. The mist was less thick at the bottom,
but still prevented me from seeing more than a dozen yards in any direction. Saraja had moved just far enough from the end of the rope to give me room to come down. When Saraja saw I was finished stowing my gear, she pointed to the crater's center. A collection of heaped boulders, rounded and obviously artificial, resolved from the fog. The nearest one was only a few feet away. "Where's Mevish?" she asked quietly. "Should be right behind me," I whispered, deciding not to tell her about Mevish's odd wave in case I'd imagined it. I shuffled to the nearby boulder heap, which turned out to be farther away than I'd realized and larger. The fog was screwing with my perceptions. Close up, the pile I'd approached reached a good hand span above my head. A figure in a white cloak and hood stepped around from behind the boulder heap. I stifled a yelp. "Who are you?" I asked, my voice a fair impression of not sounding like someone who almost crapped his pants. The figure threw back his hood. He was well into his 70s. The hand he'd used to reveal his face was covered in tattooed swirls and loops. The other held a flute the color of bone. "I'm the one who watches for intruders," he said in a weary voice. "Call me Greeter. Who are you and why are you here?" "That's our business," Saraja snapped.
"Rude," sniffed Greeter.
"You hope to pilfer the Maker's vaults.
Unless you're complete fools, you have a new strategy, one that hasn't been tried 1,000 times before. Tell me, and perhaps, together, all of us can succeed. My brothers and I will share with you what we find.
Keep silent and die here." The old man finished with a disquieting croaking noise. Laughter?
"So, the rumors are true," said Saraja, as she moved up to stand next to me. "Soul sorcerers infest the crater like roaches in a roadside inn."
"Not the honey-sweet diplomacy I would have chosen," I jumped in.
"Cooperation is possible, Greeter," I trailed off as I realized that, actually, no, I really didn't like the idea of allowing a pack of limb-severing soul sorcerers into the Maker's Hall, assuming Siraj's earlier story had been true. I needed to know more about him.
"But," prompted Greeter, the ghost of a smile on his lips,
"what was his name?" I wondered and focused on his lined, haggard face. His eyes were a faded blue like old denim. Greeter flinched, but a backwash of psychic energy slapped me like an open hand across my face. I staggered, but didn't quite bellow in surprise. "Was he warded somehow?" The old man's smile was gone.
"I suppose we'll have to kill you then."
Saraja charged Greeter. Her sword stroke missed, but he retreated a step. As he did, his white robe, hood, and wrinkly skin of his face inflated, puffing out like pale balloon. Shaggy white fur sprouted everywhere as he grew taller and taller until he towered over us. It happened fast, too fast for me to do more than gape and blink. Instead of a man, something like a giant gorilla with white fur stared down at us. White, except where its fur was stained red as if with gore from previous kills, especially around its mouth and clawed hands. The white ape kicked Saraja out of the way like she was a straw-stuffed puppet. Holy shit! She rolled to a stop and didn't move. Had the ape thing just killed her? Then it came for me. I ducked under a massive fist and ran between its legs. The mist was clearing, which was the only reason I saw something dart towards me from the side. I dived sideways, just avoiding an attack from... Fuck! One of the piled rock heaps stood up. A slab of animate stone about the shape and size of a person, and tried to sucker punch me. The second I saw it move, its name blazed in my brain. It was a golem. once this had been a soldier for the incarnations during the Age of Myth.
"Rawr!"
screamed the transformed greeter, who hadn't forgotten about me. Seeing it had my attention, the ape's bestial features stretched into a horrible grin. Saraja was probably dead, and Mevish had never come down the rope in the first place. I was facing a huge, hairy gorilla and a stone-cold killer alone. Yep, I was gonna die.
"Greeter!"
I yelled, deciding to use the name he'd given me instead of trying to dig deeper again.
"Your name is now mine. Stand quietly or lose it forever."
I was bluffing, of course. I still felt the pain from the first time I'd fished for his true name. Puzzlement scrunched the ape's face. But Greeter didn't immediately attack me again. Surprise that my ploy had worked at all kept me mute a few moments. Stumbling over my next demand would erode my claim. Saraja, battered but still kicking, raced out of the mist and stabbed the ape in the back. Its shriek was deafening. I wanted to clap my hands over my ears. A stone fist clipped me, and I stumbled back from the golem, forgetting the ape and Kephlum. I gazed at where eyes would have been on a living creature. A horrifying expanse of blank stone stared back. I desperately wished it was gone. A name occurred to me, and I said it, stuttering over the syllables in my fear. A name antithetical to animate stone, like antimatter to substance. I unnamed the golem. It exploded. I lost at least a few seconds in the flash and roar. When I blinked back to the moment, the ringing in my ears drowned out whatever Saraja was saying.
"What? Get up, Carter!"
I pushed myself upright, wincing at the oozing cuts the broken glass covering the crater floor had inflicted on my palms and fingers. Most of the mist was gone, maybe blown away by the golem detonation blast. I saw Greeter was back to his old shape, a trembling old man in bloodied robes. Maybe the golem blast had destabilized his spell. Of Mevish, there was still no sign, though the rope we'd used to descend dangled down the crater wall. At least she'd left us a way to escape.
"Behind you," said Saraja.
I glanced round and saw the retreating mist had uncovered a dark crack in the crater floor. I wasn't sure if the three additional golems, and at least twice that number of soul sorcerers, all wearing white like Greeter, had just emerged from the crack, or if they'd been standing in the mist all along, watching the fight. As I opened my mouth to lie, plead, or say something, anything to deflect what I feared was going to be my end, the fist of a fresh golem pounded me into the glassy scree.
Chapter 25 Translation Catherine Manners. Kate passed through nothing. For a moment she was nothing, except need. She wanted form again, substance and purpose. She flailed, but without limbs, screamed, but had no voice. Discordant clanks and bangs pelted her. Distant and faint at first, they grew louder and more insistent as she focused on them. Then a sound like an avalanche vibrated through her, and just like that, Catherine Manners stepped into Ardine. She knew she was in Ardine, just like she knew her name was Kate. Memory unfurled, as if she'd always known that spirits of the slain are drawn to Ardine's subterranean night vault, that the Maker and his incarnations were dead, and that magic came as naturally to some people as weaving did to others. After all, she herself could shepherd the dead, calming spirits and guiding them. "What the hell is wrong with me?" she whispered.
"You're translated," said a large man, standing next to her. A large man, but somehow also Raoul.
a Raoul about half a foot taller and wearing altogether more colorful clothing than a few seconds earlier, including two matching short swords with scarlet hilts. Before they'd stepped through that blurred continuity hanging in the computer lab of the Brazilian university.
"I'm dreaming it. Or I hit my head," she proclaimed.
Kate glanced down. The gun she'd almost shot Coulson with had become the hilt of a slender blade. Bracelets adorned her wrists, rings her fingers, and in place of her jeans, boots, and top, she wore glistening yellow robes stitched with elaborate symbols.
"You are neither dreaming nor mentally damaged, mi chula," said Raoul.
She concentrated on him, wondering if he was a dream soon to fade away with the rest of her delusion. Nope. And he really had grown in height and width, and gained two swords and elaborate leather armor that looked like it was right out of a movie set. Raoul held out his hand, and after a second she took it.
"It can be a shock the first few times. As it happens, this is the first time I've been to Ardeen myself. In fact, it's so new, I'm probably the first from Rock to come here," he trailed off.
"New? It's hundreds of thousands of years old," she countered. He cocked his head. Kate realized she was drawing on memories, the same ones that trickled into her consciousness the more she looked around. She knew Ardeen had been created, who knows how many millennia ago, by the Maker. But of course, she also knew that Carter Morrison claimed to have seeded Ardeen just a few years ago.
"I imagined everything would be more like a video game," she said, "blocky and maybe even pixelated, not like this."
Raoul nodded solemnly and squeezed her hand.
"Integrating the reality of a recursion takes time. You'll need to acclimate to the idea that this is real. Judging by the glyphs decorating your shawl, I'm guessing that you've developed a knack for calming spirits."
Kate's eyes were drawn to the largest ring on her left hand. Unlike the rest of her jewelry and belongings she'd left behind on Earth, the ring Jason Cole brought to Earth had followed her back to Ardeen. It had translated, too, taking on a new context. Whatever else it was, it also now served as her spirit focus.
"Spirit focus," she whispered, the words both familiar and new to her. Of course, she could shepherd the dead. In fact, the ghostly soul of a long-dead warrior now resided within the ring, waiting for her to call it forth.
"I must be going crazy," she said, her voice matter-of-fact.
"No," Raoul said, and patted her shoulder.
The way her sudden familiarity with Ardeen slipped into her brain was almost more unsettling than the content itself.
It was unbelievable. At least it would be unbelievable if she hadn't called on similarly crazy abilities even before leaving Earth.
Like when she jolted Coulson with energy that had left him dazed, which was right before they'd stepped through, translated to this new place.
"Stop," said Raoul. "Breathe. Stop fighting it. Just concentrate on your breathing."
She did as Raoul suggested, taking 5 long breaths.
"Better?"
"Yeah," she said, as much for her own benefit as Raoul's. Saying it out loud would make it so. "I'm done losing my shit." They stood in a metallic alcove. The cavity opened directly on a wide but dimly lit industrial catwalk that circled a metal-sided pit. Purplish light leaked from whatever lay at the bottom. Along the catwalk, opposite the pit, wide arches opened on a dozen or more separate chambers at semi-regular intervals,
the distant buzz of what sounded like table saws, the glittering flash of welding torches, and a low-level murmur of many voices reminded Kate of a factory floor. Figures moved along the catwalk and between the various doors, but none had taken any interest in Kate or Raoul. She wasn't sure why they hadn't raised a hue and cry when she and Raoul appeared, but she was happy to let the status quo roll along a while longer. The ring that had come along for the ride from Earth tingled on her finger, not unpleasantly. Maybe it was reacting to coming home again? "I have a question, Raoul. This is the ring Jason first sent across, the one I found in the BDR server room. It came with me from Brazil." She showed it to him. "It's a spirit focus here in Ardeen, but it's also the original ring. What does that mean?" Raoul took her hand and squinted at the piece of jewelry still fitted to her finger. He frowned. "I don't know. Some artifacts can translate, but they are so rare I've never seen one. Usually only ciphers move between worlds with recursors." "You can explain ciphers later. For now, tell me about this." Raoul made a tisking noise. "It must have serious power of its own. I guess I didn't think about it before. I mean, Jason originally sent this ring from Ardeen to Earth, which is actually sort of amazing. Even Ruck science would be hard-pressed to duplicate that. Had we been somehow cut off from Earth."
"Do you think it's a problem? What if this thing has magically clued in Jason that we've invaded his base?"
"It's possible," said Raoul. "So let's move quickly. We need to locate the other half of the gate."
"Good thing everyone's ignoring us," said Kate.
Raoul nodded. "And why is that?" she said. "Isn't this supposed to be Mageddon, the heart of the betrayer's evilness?"
She gestured to the two nearest vaguely illuminated figures walking along the catwalk. The figures stopped short of their alcove and turned into an open doorway. The two workers looked oddly similar to each other, and familiar. Raoul explained,
"We've taken on Ardeen's context, and we've translated directly into Mageddon. So we've taken on the veneer of those who belong here."
"Really?
Then why don't we just walk into—"
"But only for as long as we do nothing to draw attention to ourselves. The second we do something disruptive, everyone will know we don't belong."
"Yeah, otherwise it'd be too easy," she grumped. "All right, which way?"
Nothing resembling the interface they'd jumped through was evident.
"The gate has to be nearby," Raoul said. "Otherwise, we wouldn't have appeared here. I'm surprised we don't see it, truthfully. Let me ask."
Raoul waved down a lone figure wearing a black leather duster, walking along the catwalk in their direction. The purple light from the pit reflected from the figure in a particularly unsettling fashion. The newcomer seemed to truly notice her and Raoul for the first time and veered to approach them. As he drew closer, she realized the oddity was with the man himself, not the unsettling light. The skin of his face and exposed hands wasn't really reflecting light from the pit, but refracting it. She saw his jaw, his brain, as if behind hazed gelatin. The refracting light hid it until he stopped before them, but the man's features exactly resembled those of Jason Cole, not to mention Coulson, who they'd left behind on Earth. In fact, he was a perfect ringer for the translucent Jason duplicate she'd met on Earth. Kate's heart began to beat erratically in her chest and throat, fluttering like a trapped bird.
"What are you doing here?" demanded the lookalike. His voice was a match of Coulson's, an accusing finger jabbing as if he would pin them in place with it. "Don't you know?"
said Raoul, advancing a lazy step. Kate's ring tingled again, even as a new, cocky surety infused Raoul.
We were told to expect a tour of the facility by someone who looked just like you, though he was less, see-through.
The man may have blinked, though with his lack of skin pigmentation, Kate wasn't certain.
A homunculus brought you to the foundries? Why?
We're emissaries from Mandariel. We are here to seal the non-aggression pact between our nations and Mageddon.
Raoul raised a fist.
And to discuss what to do about our common enemy, Azurium.
Knowledge unfolded behind Kate's left eye like an incipient migraine. Azurium, also called the Queendom, was a prominent power in Ardeen and currently ruled by Queen Elendine.
Mandariel was a much younger nation ruled by the 12 princes. The two powers were not especially friendly.
The look-alike shook his head, obviously confused.
So was Kate. What the fuck was Raoul trying to do?
Listen, Raoul said. The betrayer himself asked us here to explore whether such a pact made sense. But ever since we've arrived, all we've gotten is delay after delay. The first interesting thing that happened to us since we've arrived was being asked if we'd like to look around. What did you call them? He snapped his fingers. Oh, the foundries, right. Then we were abandoned here until you came along. What's your name?
As if compelled by Raoul's sudden request, the duplicate Jason said, I'm Gamma, First Lieutenant of War. Kate guessed that Raoul was being more than deceptively persuasive. He was actually exerting some kind of mental influence as he spun his lies.
Unbelievable! Yet here he was, chatting up a clone.
And where is War? Said Raoul. He was supposed to meet us.
It took everything Kate had not to glance at Raoul like he was a lunatic.
He is attending to private matters, Gamma replied. A sour expression on the duplicate's face revealed that he wasn't exactly happy with whatever Jason was doing, or maybe he didn't know. Either way, Kate was relieved that the betrayer, or Coulson, wasn't around to end their charade.
Then it falls to you to show us around the foundries, declared Raoul,
an approving smile breaking on his face. As if he couldn't help himself, Gamma returned the expression. Kate managed not to snort. She wasn't sure who she was more viscerally disgusted with, Gamma, for being yet another version of Jason fucking Cole, or Raoul for being such a fucking liar. Had Raoul ever led her on in the same way? He'd be sorry if she discovered he'd tried the not-the-droids-you're-looking-for tactic with her. Both Coulson and the duplicate she'd met in the server room so many months ago, they'd been like Gamma, a person molded from the identity of someone else. Server room Jason had died, melting away, before she'd understood anything. He'd apologized, though she hadn't then known why. Separated from his parent, maybe he'd had second thoughts about his role in Jason's plot, about leaving behind the ring containing the Trojan horse quantum code. Kate idly traced the curve of the cold band on her finger with her thumb. And now, before her, stood one more duplicate, his mind yet another instance of Jason's. Was he in lockstep with the original, or was he like a twin, a completely separate person in his own right? Server room Jason hadn't struck her as someone who would have been so easily misled. Then again, he hadn't had to deal with Raoul's superpower for twisting brains into pretzels. She felt a little sorry for Gamma, despite everything. Gamma motioned them around the mouth of the monstrous pit. Kate glanced down. Amethyst light glittered far below, winking in code she couldn't decipher. What's this? She asked.
War has many projects, Gamma threw over his shoulder. If this one ever comes to fruition, we'll have no need of alliances or treaties. We'll have all the power we need at our fingertips.
War mentioned he developed some kind of connection to a higher world, Raoul said. To a place he called Earth. Is this the portal?
Gamma stopped in mid-stride, turning. Confusion wrinkled his face.
War told you about Biter? But that's...
Raoul cranked up the persuasion.
Yes, that's classified. But War wants Mandariel's friendship. He mentioned it. Biter, as a sign of good faith. Being called the betrayer means you have to work double hard to engender trust among your would-be allies.
Kate glanced into the pit again. The purple light at the bottom looked nothing like the portal they used to arrive in Mageddon. She couldn't say that out loud without blowing their cover, so instead she said, "This doesn't look like the Biter portal War described to us." Gamma's look of stark incomprehension, perhaps even betrayal, softened.
"That's because this isn't Biter. Like I said, we're taking it slow on the pit reactor. One mistake could blast Mageddon from existence in a flare of loose chaos."
Kate and Raoul eased back a step. The ghost of a smile lifted Gamma's mouth.
"Well, if War wants you to see what's in the contact foundry, so be it," Kate said.
"The contact foundry?"
"Biter is in the contact foundry," answered Gamma.
Raoul said, "That's the spirit."
The clone led him another half-turn around the pit, then ducked under a large arch. Inside, two massive crystal screens, 3 stories tall if they were a foot, faced off across the length of the room. The tall surfaces rapidly flashed scenes, each lasting no more than an eye blink. A city skyline, a highway system streaming with cars, a farm, an airport, on, and all of them from Earth. At the center of the space, midway between the two screens, a blurry smear hung in the air, like the one that had formed when Coulson appeared in Brazil, except this one stuttered, randomly appearing and disappearing. Noise like the static from a dead channel issued from it each time it appeared. A handful of clones, their skin apple-red, wearing armor nearly the same color, rushed about on scaffolding suspended along the edges of the display surfaces, pulling oversized levers and turning dials as if racing each other for a mad science prize. A handful of clones lay broken on the ground at the base of either monolith, burnt and unmoving. Pale smoke spiraled up from one of the bodies. "What's happened?" Gamma demanded of the room. Except for some anxious glances from a few reds, no one answered. Gamma walked farther into the chamber towards the stuttering discontinuity.
"Answer me. Where's Sigma?" he asked.
One red homunculus threw a lever, then glanced around long enough to gasp.
"He went to investigate intruders on the other side of the link. He wasn't gone more than a minute when the portal slipped. There was an explosion. The connection has destabilized."
Raoul glanced at Kate. She silently mouthed the name Coulson at him. He considered half a second, then nodded. Gamma spared them a quick "excuse me" and rushed to help the reds. Kate and Raoul found themselves alone, standing a dozen feet from the discontinuity.
"If we jumped through this, I suppose we'd show up back on Earth," Kate muttered.
"I expect so, yes," he said. "It's a gateway. A translation gate. Though I wouldn't chance it at the moment. He looks ill."
Kate studied the flickering hole in existence, then shifted her gaze to the crystal screens. "They destroyed the quantum computer on Earth to unbalance Earth's connection to our Dean. Here in Mageddon, the quantum computer's analog might well be the twin imaging devices over which the clones swarmed."
"Let's break those," she pointed to the screens.
The gate was only a byproduct of the flickering surfaces. The magical mechanisms keeping the gate open must lay inside them.
Agreed. But right now? Asked Raoul. It's crowded in here. Perhaps we should wait until odds shift in our favor.
We might not get another chance, she replied. Use your mind-control ability to tell everyone to leave. He gave her a measured look.
It's not mind-control. It's the ability to make people think I'm someone other than I am, or fast-talk my way out of some situations. Anyway, it's hard for me to affect more than a couple of people at once.
Kate grunted noncommittally.
And if you're wondering, no, I've never fast-talked you, Kate. You'd remember.
He knew her well. She decided to believe him, but not let him completely off the hook. For your sake, I'd better not find out otherwise, she said. Then focus on Gamma. He's the one in charge here. Raoul sighed. He studied the transparent clone of Jason who was directing his red-hued siblings on the scaffolding.
How should I play this? I wonder, he muttered.
Then he walked over to Sigma and tapped the clone on his shoulder.
Not now, Sigma said. War has a message, he says.
I thought you were an envoy from Mandariel.
Raoul shook his head impatiently.
That's just my cover. We're actually agents war employs beyond the walls of Megiddon.
Even from where she was standing, Kate's brain prickled at the surge of invisible persuasion rolling off Raoul. Gamma must have felt it too, because he began to stammer, all the while looking at Raoul as if the man had just declared he was Santa Claus.
Listen, this is war's message, Raoul continued. You need to head to the west wall immediately. War's waiting there. He needs you. He's hurt. He just survived an assassination attempt, but more assassins are coming. And take your friends, he pointed to the other clones.
Gamma nodded slowly. Then all expression drained from his face.
No, he said. I don't think so.
I said.
Gamma punched Raoul in the face. Prickling sensation ceased as Raoul's head rocked back. The clone followed up with a roundhouse kick to Raoul's midsection.
Hey, she yelled, and tried what she'd done to Coulson in Brazil.
Last time it just sort of happened. It was like trying to remember a word just on the tip of her tongue. That was just out of reach.
No, it wasn't a word. It was a feeling, a sensation like conviction. And then she had it. Electricity curled out of nowhere and zapped Gamma.
The clone's clear skin hazed where lightning burned him, but it didn't put him down. Slowed and hurt, he continued advancing on Raoul, expertly jabbing, kicking, and elbowing like an MMA fighter. Given that he was a clone of war, it made sense that he was adept with weapons of all kinds, even his empty hands. For his part, Raoul gave up ground in measured steps, circling rather than letting Gamma back him up against a wall. Kate's lightning bolt had distracted Gamma, at least. Enough for Raoul to unsheath his red-hilted short swords, one in each hand. He wove blades in swift patterns between himself and the clone. Gamma stopped advancing, but a happy grin split the duplicate's face. That probably didn't bode well. Crap! Raoul cut and parried Gamma's panther quick strikes, shouting,
I can keep this poser busy, Michula. Destroy the gate generators!
He did look as if he could handle himself, so Kate decided to believe him. She turned to the nearest screen, wondering what she should try first. A grenade would be handy, but she was fresh out. She could try the lightning again, but a tightness behind her eyes when she tried triggering it for a third time suggested she needed wait a bit, unless she wanted to burn out her mind. A couple of the red clones on the scaffolding shot her worried glances as she approached, but continued their frenzied work.
They seemed convinced they could salvage the connection if given enough time. Maybe that's what she should do. Distract them from effecting repairs, or whatever they were doing, long enough for everything to fall apart. She lifted the ring. The one Jason had called the Ring of Desire, but which now served as the focus of her power in Ardeen to shepherd souls. From it, she called the warrior spirit that nestled within. She learned his name, even as it passed her lip.
Darneth, come forth, aid me!
Thick mist steamed from her ring, forming the ghostly image of a figure in armor wielding a phantom blade.
As you command, the spirit whispered. She shivered. It was damn spooky despite everything.
She gestured to the nearest clone and yelled, "Eliminate that one!" Darneth's hollow gaze lingered on her for an instant as if in protest of his fate. Then he complied, rolling upward to threaten the red she'd pointed out. The homunculus heard her too. It turned from whatever desperate task that had consumed it to defend itself. The spirit moved slowly towards the clone, then paused in midair, light from the screens flickering through it. It wasn't attacking, which was fine. Her goal had been to distract, not that she'd have minded if Darneth had followed through. But she'd never met Darneth before, had never helped ease his spiritual pain, nor commanded him either. She hadn't built up any trust with him. She sensed, through the vague connection they shared, that he wasn't willing to risk his own continued existence by becoming corporal enough to attack and be attacked in turn. Kate glanced at the nearest homunculus, whose attention remained fixed on his controls. The tightness behind her eyes had eased somewhat. So she released a stroke of lightning, striking him in the back. She couldn't help feeling slightly guilty at screeching and smoking. The red spun around. Hate filled his eyes, and he leaped from the scaffolding to close the distance between them, smoke streaming from its wound. If the red hadn't misjudged the distance, it might have gone badly for her. But the red smashed hard onto the floor at her feet. It didn't get up. She stared at the body, her mouth hanging open. It was dead. She'd killed him.
Catherine, came Rawl's warning.
He still sparred with Gamma, and from the wet blood spotting his clothing, he'd taken a couple of serious hits. Why had he called out to her? She glanced around to see a newcomer enter the contact foundry. A thing, half-crow, half-leprous Jason clone, stood in the entrance. A fell light flickered between the feathers of the thing's wings, forking into the floor. A claw burst from its clacking beak mouth. The insidious sound made her brain ring like the clapper in a bell. Then it went for her. She dodged left, putting the flickering mouth of the translation gate between herself and it. The monster came on, unconcerned about the discontinuity in its path. It opened its mouth, and tentacles with even tinier mouths writhed within. She screamed. She couldn't help it. It brushed the translation gate as it came for her. Scarlet light outlined the fluctuating hole in space, emitting a blast of heat intense enough to curl her eyelids. The beast's hungry claws turned into a steam train whistle of pain. Half the creature was pulled through the gate, but the other half remained behind. That half slumped in a spray of red fluid that splattered and sizzled on the gate's white-hot margin.
"The connection's degraded!"
a red on the scaffolding yelled, his voice horrified.
"Fix it!" barked Gamma,
his attention divided between Warul and the unfurling disaster. Kate glanced at what remained of Mr. Crow, who wasn't clever enough by half. Nope, it wasn't getting up, whatever it was. She backed away from the wildly fluctuating gate, then hurled another eye-searing bolt at the red who looked most intent on his work. The jagged light cut deep into the clone's side. It staggered mutely, then dropped over the edge to lay unmoving. The sound of the body hitting the floor made her feel slightly sick. Pain speared between her eyes, as if she'd run the 50-meter dash. Fatigue pulled at her limbs, and a wave of dizziness made her stagger. If she kept hurling her unearthly power, she was going to burn herself up. She needed some kind of weapon. Hands shaking, she rifled through the belongings of the Red who tried to tackle her. A crash, and an answering cry of pain from Raoul made her fumble and drop the short sword she'd pulled from the clone's belt, so she grabbed the rod that was sheathed next to the sword. The moment her fingers touched the rod, they tingled. She left the sword where it lay and straightened. A nugget of knowledge opened in her mind. The thing was a kind of war wand employed in Ardeen called an Asher. She sensed that the Asher was an ideal way to break stuff. She spun and pointed the liberated wand at one of the crystal screens currently displaying a satellite view of a large city on Earth. She concentrated, and the wand spat a line of green energy at the nearest crystal panel. It was like the time she'd smashed a window with a hammer to break into an abandoned motorhome. The crystal shattered with a peculiar barking crash, shards raining down on the closest Reds. Her spirit, Darneth, returned. It whispered, "If you remain where you stand, you'll die." So speaking, it wrapped itself around her like a swaddling cloak, as if trying to hug her or protect her. White light enveloped her, even as what she imagined as a human-sized fly swatter smashed her across the length of her body. "I'm all right," she rasped, hoping it was true, though she wasn't sure to whom she spoke. She was sprawled on the ground, her limbs entwined with a duplicate who fared much worse in the explosion than her. It could have been the one she'd looted, or a different one. How did the fucking things tell each other apart? Pain needled through her joints and neck as she tried standing. "Less all right than I thought," she amended, and stayed on the floor. One panel was gone, as were all the Reds who'd tended it. A crater-like blast pattern scorched the floor where the translation gate had hung in the air. A zigzagging crack splintered the face of the opposite panel. She couldn't see Raoul or Gamma, which worried her. Fresh rubble lay between her and where they'd been fighting at the chamber's edge. They'd been farther from the gate detonation than she'd been. Raoul was all right, she told herself, unless that rubble, was it from the ceiling, had fallen on him? Pushing through the sharp spikes of pain, she was ready for this time. She got up. Darneth was gone. The spirit's misty shape was nowhere in the chamber, as was its sense of presence she'd earlier detected in the ring. Darneth had wound itself around her to protect her. The spirit hadn't been willing to fight for her, but it had tried to save her, and now she wasn't sure where it was. A hollow feeling made her swallow. Funny, because, in a way, Darneth wasn't real. Except he was. That was all real. At least it was as real as life on Earth, which was made up of particles, waves, and maybe tiny vibrating strings even deeper down. Whatever dark energy mechanism was imposing order and structure to everything around her was just as comprehensive in fashioning an instance of unique reality. Which meant that the Reds she'd killed directly, and those who had died in the subsequent blast she'd caused were also real. Clones or not, they'd been alive, but no more. She bent double and retched.
Chapter 26 Reflection. Elendine, Queen of Hazurium. 7 moons fell among the brilliant stars along their nightly course. Each lunar sphere was named for a rule,
or perhaps an incarnation, for they were one and the same. The glimmer of false dawn, edging both horizons, meant it was near middle night, when the sun swam beneath Ardeen, illuminating its craggy, barren underside. Though Queen Elendine and her host were closer to the Dalen's western edge, nothing blocked their sightline eastward across the empty glass desert. The hard plain had already radiated away the heat from the day before, rendering the night surprisingly frigid. The darkness and the morning hours of the next day still offered at least 9 or 10 hours of travel time across the desert's reflective surface. Not long after that, as the risen sun crested towards noon, without clouds it would grow so hot that they'd need shelter, which was a difficult proposition out on the glass. Only fools would choose to go in that direction. Yet it was their course, because that way lay Mageddon. Elendine carefully reached into a wicker cage and pulled out a tiny bird. Wings fluttering, it chirped at her, "Hello," she told it. "Are you ready to find the way forward?" The bird chirped again. The queen smiled. The creature had been a lucky find, considering all that had happened since they'd surprised the Sark in the Green Wilds. Surviving the Sark attack had been her number one priority, and thanks to their planning and the skill and bravery of her people, they'd done exactly that. The Sark had been woefully unprepared for an army of Hazurian's finest. Surprised, and likely terrified that they were the target of a much larger invasion, the creatures pulled back into their Green Wilds' lairs. A 3-day passage, without any further encounters with the debased Kephlum, saw her army to the southern edge of the forest. Their good luck failed. A particularly rabid Sark tribe infested a ruined fortress overlooking the crossing of the Drudessa River, which was some considerable distance from the bowels of the Green Wilds. No one had expected any further trouble with Sark so far from their haunts. When about half of her army was across the river, stretched out and vulnerable, the savages boiled out of the fortress on the opposite bank in a perfectly timed ambush. She'd lost at least 20 peacemakers, but in the end, 1,000 warriors against a single tribe of Sark, no matter how bloodthirsty, ended with the Sark's elimination. Flora would have been appalled. Though her mother would have been proud of the queen's tactics, Elendine was sure, if she'd been around to see them. Elendine had ordered the wounded tended and sent a small unit into the fortress to scout for any additional danger. They returned a few hours later, claiming the creatures would be no further trouble, and carrying salvaged Sark treasure she allowed them to keep for their effort, all except for the little bird in her hand, which they'd given her. It was a seer dove, pearlescent, with a delicate beak. Unlike most of its avian kin, it knew the pockets, cracks, and wrecks littering the desert. The Sark probably kept it for the same use she had in mind. Elendine raised the creature. Its scaly feet pinched her thumb. She said, "Seek your path eastward. Fly." The seer dove took wing. She half expected it to wheel back towards the Sark fortress or northwest towards the Green Wilds. But whether it was trained or because that was simply its nature, the dove fluttered southeast, out across the reflective plain. "Sound the horn," she told Navarre. The first protector complied, sending a long, high call ringing across the assembled ranks. Her forces moved out with the queen in their lead, her eyes on the dove. They walked into the night, reflected stars and tumbling moons at their feet. As the sun's disk broke over the horizon like a molten gold coin, guilt stabbed Elendine. She hadn't spared a second for Flora's plight since well before the Drudessa River crossing. After spending so many months almost prostrate at sorrow's altar, it seemed like a kind of betrayal that she hadn't given Flora's memory its due recently. Going over her death again and again somehow kept the woman part of the present and not merely a shade of the past. Except, not thinking about it was easier, a thought that made her feel even more guilty. But she did have other things to think about. Azurium couldn't stand for the embodiment of its power, the symbol of rulership, to be stolen without an answer. Their standing as a primary power in Ardeen was at stake. Keeping this expedition on track required nothing less than Elendine's full attention. And yet, wasn't it to snatch her sister back from the Night Vault that she was actually challenging the betrayer? Why she led her forces across the most desolate part of Ardeen? Elendine knew of no other way to effect that escape other than with the Ring of Death. Oddly, she could still feel it on her finger. A phantom band, like a severed limb, cold and serene in the face of all calamities. Given all that she was doing to recover that ring, and thus Flora's escape from death, Elendine reasoned she didn't have the time to grieve. Shielding the blinding dawn and its equally blazing reflection with one hand, Elendine gazed across the reflective plain. She'd lost sight of the bird hours ago, but not before establishing the ruler's straight direction of its flight. Seer doves flew between oases, and an observant traveler who, following one's path, could pick their way across the desert, including armies led by observant queens. She didn't need to find water or food. Her forces carried adequate provisions. Just a crack, hill, or even a lone dune of encroaching dust from the borderlands that was large enough to shelter her forces during peak heat if they dug in. No cave, dune, structure, or other protective feature leaped out at her as she scanned the landscape. That wasn't a complete disaster, because they had a few hours before the warmth really picked up, but it concerned her, because it would take about that much time to walk as far as she could currently see. It was even farther if they turned back. They had to go forward. Navarre watched, a question in the angle of her ears. Elendine said, "Onward!" and Navarre blew the horn, signaling the short rest was over. The army marched on into the sunrise. Less than an hour later, with the sun well up, the sweat trickled under her armor and stung her eyes. She wiped her forehead with the cuff of her sleeve, managing to keep an exasperated profanity from escaping her lips. Everyone looked to her for strength, not complaints. That's when she spied a narrow crack in the glass ahead and to the left. She pointed it out to Navarre, who ran ahead to check it out. Ran instead of rode because they lost their mounts when her ships foundered in the storm. That loss wounded her pride as much as anything else, but Elendine knew that for Navarre it was worse. The first protector had formed a close bond with her charger, and its loss weighed on the Kephlum heavily. Not that she'd ever say. The regent in Hazirium had much to answer for, not the least being the death of horses. All would be accounted for when Elendine returned, she promised herself for the 100th or 1,000th time. The dull anger that burned when she thought of the regent was one of the goads that kept her moving forward. "This may serve," called Navarre and motioned for Elendine. She joined her and looked down a much larger space than she'd expected. The crack was narrow, but it opened up into a hollow, darkened space a few feet beneath the glass. A rubble of boulders actually looked as though it would make a passable stair. Cool air and the faint scent of water came up from below. "This is where the seer dove was leading," she said, hoping it was true and that it was large enough to give everyone a chance to rest in the shade. If it wasn't, they devised a schedule to rotate the army into the coolness, unit by unit. "I'll call up a team to investigate," said Navarre. "We don't have time. The sun is going to bake us if we don't do this quick. I'm going to check it out." "My queen!" protested Navarre. If it wasn't Navarre's job to protect the Queen, Elendine was pretty sure the First Protector would kill her one of these days. "I'll keep a force of peacemakers at my elbow," Elendine said.